Okay, here we go. So today is Tuesday the 5th of May, and we're here again in Anne Newmarch's studio. It's Leanne Gould with the last interview with Anne Newmarch, and we're just looking at the studio again. And Anne, you were talking about an art exhibit that you'd been in recently where it was your tattoos on your mother's embroidery work. And we're going to have a look at that and take some photos of it.
Yep. Okay, now the work in fact is up there on the board. There's my two left and right hand, and one in the middle that I don't think I've even seen for a long time. I did it collaboratively with a photographer called Michael Klavanik, and the show was at Nexus Multicultural Centre. It was very much focused, though, on the snakes and daggers and dragons kind of stuff. I think I was probably the only artist that actually had real tats and that old wound sites, because so the series was called Mother's Needles, My Wounds. So each of the tats to begin with started with the wound site, and then they became celebratory in some cases, or relationship establishment, especially one with my daughter, or just reminders to be very careful of my hands, which are the most precious things in my whole body. The one in the centre that climbs up the back of my spine is where I had my coccyx removed, which is, I think, one of the most painful experiences I've ever had. Okay, there we are. We're back on again. We've had some technical problems with the camera that just doesn't want to work, and with the new batteries it doesn't want to work either. So we're just sitting here sulking because it doesn't want to take the photos. But we found new AA batteries, and they didn't work either. So I offered my camera, which I know the battery's charged, but I can't even turn the power on. For some reason, I think that Leanne and I are jinxed today.
Just with cameras. We've got a camera jinx on us, I think.
Yes.
We're just trying again. And it's taking me... If we warm it up, it'll take a photo.
All right. Stick it underneath your jumper then, or in your pocket. If I warm mine up in my knickers, we'll see if... mine worked, but mine's never done it before, and it's really quite new. I've never had that experience at all. Sometimes I think things do, just at the time, for some reason. I mean, I really do believe that there's something in the ether that either makes you work, stops you from work, or causes everything to go astray. And I think that's happening to us with our cameras today. Maybe it's because I cancelled dinner tonight.
No,
perhaps if I ring him up and arrange to get over there by 6 o'clock, our cameras might start working.
Well, that's a thought. It could be.
Yeah. I believe in the magic that's in the air, that you can make magic, or you can cast aside magic, or, my mother used to call me a witch. She'd yell out from that lounge room while my sister and I was doing doing the dishes, and my sister kept giving me those knuckle punches in the arm, which was so painful. And I'd say, "Stop it, stop it." And my mother would yell out, "Anne, you sound like a witch." And I carried that burden of having a witch inside me till I was 40, actually. I was really frightened that I was evil inside.
Why did you automatically assume...
That's not, I don't care, it can go on.
Why did you automatically assume that a witch would be evil? You can have good witches and bad witches.
Yes, but see, I never knew about white witches. And she was accusing me of being a black witch. And then she got very frightened of me because I had more stamina and guts than... and did things that she wasn't brave enough to do herself, and I'd argue and whatever, and I had my own mind, and dismissed her idea of having no career and took on a career that she told me I was never allowed to do. But with help from the university shrink and another psychiatrist, I learnt that in fact a lot of people carry those kind of traumas, and that mine happened to be about being a black witch, which he said, "You're not, really." So I thought, okay, then I learned about white witches, so I turned them into white witches. And what I love doing, I don't know if we've discussed that before, with a telephone call where someone has to go through a whole lot of labour explaining this or sorting through their computer and their computer isn't working, or they have to go to a backup, or they give me a lot of assistance and I say, "Thank you so much." And then I say, "What's your favourite flower?" And they say, "Oh, I never thought about that." The last one, just yesterday, she said, "Irises, I think." And I said, "What colour, the purple ones or those beautiful old brown ones?" "Purple ones." And I said, "Okay, well, I'll send you a dozen. And what colour vase would you like them in?" She said, "Oh, I don't know." I said, "Well, what about a kind of a burnt orange that's the opposite of the violet? And you can put them on your desk and you won't ever have to throw them out. You can have them there whenever you want and put them away whenever you want, but they won't die on you. And I give that as a gift to you." And they say, "Oh, thank you." And I've done that with so many people who've helped me over the phone, is give them this imaginary thing. Or I'll say to someone, like the guy who fixed my watch band and it was too tight, I had to take it back, and he did it again, did it all for free. And I said, "Look, I've got to pay you." He said, no, it's okay. I said, "All right." He said, and this is the same kind of thing. So, well, I looked at my watch and I said, "Well, it's now 3:30. At about between six, oh, let me think. Between six, hang on, I'll just, between 6:15 and 6:45, I think that's right, yes, between 6:15 and 6:45, you're going to see something that will make you smile. But you have to look out for it, so you have to be aware that that's the time that there's going to be something beautiful you'll see that you haven't recognised before. It might just be a leaf, or I don't know what, I can't tell you what it's going to be, but that's the time to look out for something that will make you smile." And they always look at me strangely and go, she's a witch. I'm fascinated. So it means that at that time, they look at their watch and all of a sudden the world is a place that they can see differently. And I think that's a white witch kind of thing to do. There's no magic really, it's just psychology really, and giving people the chance to whatever.
To think a little bit more differently, or to be a little bit more open-minded.
To be, or to spend that bit of time aware of something that's not their usual drive home or their usual life or all the things we accept as problems or pleasures or constants, but to have just a period of time in which to go, "Oh, there's something else to think about now." And I find it's amazing how people are so fascinated by it and get such a joy out of, you know, being sent a dozen... half a dozen white roses, and the vase will be pink, I think, or maybe dappled pink and white. "Oh," she said, "really? You don't have to do that." And I said, "Well, I actually can't afford to, but I'm doing it over the phone, so I'm putting it in your head. So I'm quite happy with myself now to be a witch. Because I know I'm not a black witch. I don't do nasty things. Unless people are really nasty to me, then I might do things. I think we've talked about, like, spray blood through the gun hole, the gun shop's keyhole, or paint red paint down the broken stovey pole that was in the wrong place.
I loved what your son did, which was to go around and paint everybody's headlights, spray paint them black. I think that's just gorgeous.
It's really creative, really, isn't it?
It is. It's very creative. Mm. It takes a certain amount of thought, I think.
Me? Yeah, I'll just put my cigarette down a bit. And I find my works like that. I don't know if we've discussed that before, but I don't sell much apart from to state galleries and both interstate and internationally. But they're not really good things for private collections until maybe 3 or 4 or even 10 years after the event that all of a sudden people can accept the idea that I'm trying to paint or get either. But what I want my work to do is not stand as beautiful pieces of art by themselves, although I think some of them do, to someone who appreciates that, what I'm doing, but is to make the space between the image I'm making and their conscious and subconscious mind. So there's that gap in between, it's the space between the painting and the viewer. That's the most important thing to me. And a lot of people have the best comments I've got have been like that, like the whole show has to hang together rather than be individual pieces that, you want to take home or want to buy. So I kind of knock out my market in a way, so I don't sell much. But I do have a lot of people come away with saying, that was a wonderful experience. And that's what I want, for them to imagine the space between the work and the idea. And I think I did tell you about the floral mural where I was absolutely amazed that a man brought a friend up and described it to him, and his friend was blind. And I think that was just total amazement. Yes. And my idol, of course, is René Magritte, and he used to paint surrealist paintings, but not like Salvador Dali, not out of drugs or, any of that sort of, subconscious dreaming stuff, but consciously. And he would have his poet friends around who would all offer names, and his paintings were always named by one of the poets. And I really loved that idea. So it's always between, say, the poet's expression in words to the painter's expression in visual images. And I think that's where magic exists with art. And so much stuff I see now is about, either pretty pictures on the wall or making a name for yourself. But not very many people think about the space in between the viewer and the audience. And I know with my teaching that's what I always taught. Is it's about communication. Who is your audience? How do you reach them? What do you do to reach them? And the word compromise is the most fabulous word. It's often seen as a bad thing, but to do what you want to do between your ideas and your audience's understanding is that in many ways you need to compromise, and it's a really positive thing. Yeah.
Okay, so we were talking about compromise in presenting your work. Does that mean that when you present your work, you present it on the one level, which is the level that you think that people will perceive it best, or do you present it on all of the levels that you see it at, the level that you particularly want to present it at, as well as the levels that you think that it's
best? Well, so absolutely, yes. And that's another thing that I use a lot in my teaching, is that paintings have to have various levels. First of all, you've got to get someone's attention to stop and look at it. If it's not attractive, they'll look at the next one. Or if your composition is wrong and the arrow is going to the left, they'll look at the next painting to the left. So you have to hold them within an eye movement that they want to stay in to start off with, that's aesthetically interesting. Need not be pretty, but fascinating, or pretty, or whatever, but holds their eyes in a particular movement. And every painting has in it, I'm looking at that one now, a movement where your eyes travel around in a certain way, and the artist doesn't allow that eye to escape from the confines of the canvas, or whatever the piece of work is. And then as that happens, they begin to see, oh, another layer. And from there, that leads them to see yet another layer, and then a deeper meaning layer. So those paintings are layered in a sense that it allows the viewer also to feel that they're in control of seeing the layers themselves. But that's not a compromise, that's the art. That's the art of creating something that is truly a work of art, I think, I believe, and I've always taught that you take into mind your viewer, of course, and the work exists between your viewer's mind and the surface, but the surface is also constructed so you have the message, and then you have another message, or the same message, or the message gets deeper as the layers increase in the viewer's mind, and in fact in the work itself. Like with the works over there and the work I'm doing now on anatomy and cultural pattern, called Cultural Patterns from All Over the World, and Human Frailty, the first time I took them up to the photocopy shop, she said, "Oh, these are really pretty, Annie." And then she goes, "Oh, hell, I didn't see that. Oh, wow, I can see what you're..." And that's just the lady in the photocopy shop who knows nothing about art. But to start off with, it's got to hold the viewer, and then if it's worth anything, it's got to move through much deeper layers of meaning.
Those pieces have so much work in them. There is just so much detail and so much work in them.
These little ones here?
Yes.
But they've only just started.
You said that. You said you've got so much more to do.
Oh, yeah, masses more. Absolutely masses more.
And a lot of your work, I'm trying to think how to put it. A lot of your work is almost painful to look at. There's so much feeling in it, so much emotion in it.
And that's mainly why I'm not rich. But people aren't prepared to have it in their living rooms. But you see, the art galleries
doesn't quite stack up against the vase of flowers, huh?
No. They'd much rather have something pretty. And I don't paint pretty pictures. Well, I mean, I have, and quite a few of my images are deliberately about prettiness. Like my kitchen series, just of salt glazed bottles and things on shelves, and very simple. They're aesthetically very beautiful, and they're also incredibly peaceful. But that's about a kitchen where most women are so busy doing things that it adds some real peace in contemplation of the image. Or my floral things, like my Sturt Pea pictures. They aren't just Sturt Peas, they're also named Malu Guru Guru, which is Pitjantjatjara for kangaroo's eye. So they still have an extra layer. Or the other ones that is a series that's really popular is two prints I did with my three black cats, and they're just big lines with these yellow eyes in them, and everyone goes, oh, I love the cats. And I thought, well, they're too, they're not saying enough. So one was called Cats for Independence, and the other one was called Cats, then they were all standing up together, the three of my pussycats, and they, I know which one's which. They were my black cat. And the other three are lying down, and they're called Cats Against Uranium. And it makes people laugh. And so there's humour, but there's also to think of what these cats are doing, you know, and what people do, stand together for, you know, for their rights, or lie across the road in front of the bulldozers. But they're only pussycats. So, I mean, in some way you're very clever. I would say The Frames, for example, which is the latest series, they're huge, elaborate frames, like old Victorian frames that you might see in an art gallery with a huge constable in the middle, or, you know, a Renaissance painting, all with big glitterati frames that would have cost a bloody fortune. Well, I had some little ones made up, and photographed them and photoshopped them and changed colours and whatever, so they all look different. But the space in the middle, instead of having a big frame around a huge painting, there's a little tiny weeny, maybe half inch by half inch spot in the middle. So it's all frame. And in that half inch spot, there's nothing. So I then gave them, I mean, it was called Anticipation. So it was really about imagination, what you would like to see in that space, which I've actually given to the audience. I've given them the frame, they can make their own picture. And then I've given them titles to help them to get somewhere. Like the red one over there is called Wet Roses, or something else. And all of them were named, like one's called, what's the cook's name? Sarah Lee. Or something else. And all of them have a title then in brackets, or something else. And the or something else is for the audience to say, I would like to see that in there, or I can imagine that. And they can change it every day if they want. So the painting becomes kind of alive in their imagination in some sense. I'm actually really proud of that set of paintings. I think they're great. But that's only one. But there's another one upstairs, it's a beautiful green one. It's called Mine, or something else. And people think, oh, I can't buy that because it's hers. Well, I said, no, it's called Mine. It can be yours too. Yeah, and they're great because they're just two-dimensional images, but they look so three-dimensional, you could almost touch them and imagine the surface of those frames. And I don't think I've shown you the actual frames I've taken them from. I should do that if you've got one shot.
We can try.
Yeah, I've just hung them all upstairs, and there's little tiny things that the frame had put together out of scraps, but I'm really pleased with that series. So the last show at Prospect was The Frames, which was to do with imagination and what I've just talked about. And the other side were wishbones, which were actually shadows of wishbones, which I'd laid down on paper and sprayed, so they were only the semblance or the reminders. But there was no title that allowed the audience for a particular wish. So they're all the wishes that they might have, that they might see in the notion of a wishbone. Except I had one item, which I guess identified it a bit, which was a long glass jar that you'd normally put spaghetti in or something, or a chemist might use for something. And it was filled with real wishbones, and it had engraved on it wish risk reserves. So it was like a lolly jar of reserves that you give to your kiddies to open and have a wish. But it was, you always take a risk. So it was wish risk reserves. Because the risk is always who's going to get the better side.
Who's actually going to get the wish?
Yeah. But it also, I mean, the others, they were allowing everyone to have both sides. And in fact, very funny, because they're all from chickens or chicken wishbones that I cut out of the dog's frames. My favourite meal was Thai green curry wishbones. So I would give the rest to the dogs and I'd save the wishbone with its flesh around and clean it all up, then flense it and boil it and put it into sterilising stuff, bleach, put it in the sun, etc. So nice and clean. And I gave them out at Christmas time to all our family. And the very strange thing was, every one of them broke, so no one got the wish. They both broke either side, and the middle fell off. And I thought, this is just amazing. It's probably because I bleached them. They must have changed the bone structure in some way. But it was, I didn't expect that to happen. And when they're in the gallery, I had a bowl of them that just says, take one, make a wish. And they were there for the audience to take one from the bowl and break it. And Joanna said, the helper there said, we should have a bowl for olive pips, but, you know, a bowl to put the broken bits in. And I said, no, I want to see what happens. Some people put them in their pockets or, you know, pinned them on their brooches and took them home to use for a friend later. Other people broke them there and with another friend. And I found that they were putting them at the bottom of the dish. And then there were someone who started arranging them, all the broken and the complicated ones, in a little circle around the bowl. And after that, everyone that took one and broke one completed this circle. And I was just, it was magic, really. Really magic. I should have taken a photograph of that, but I didn't. But no one discarded them. No one dropped them on the floor. There was some sort of respect for themselves, I think, in placing it back again as a gesture. This is my wish. I either got it or didn't get it, but it's a risk. And I mean, I ran the risk that they might get chucked all over the gallery floor and I'd have to do a big clean-up, but it didn't happen. And stuff like that is real magic, I think. I was brought up in Somerton Park and my father bought two blocks because they were cheap after the war and built the house there. And there was no other houses around. In fact, we were due to be in a place called Baker Street, which didn't exist. And my father actually dug Baker Street. And as a little girl, I watched him make a roadway up to Diagonal Road. But across the way was just this immense paddock where Mr. Smart, who was the rubbish collector, or a very strange collector, had his wooden cart up the road, and he had about a dozen Clydesdale draft horses who used to just roam free, no fences or anything, in this area. And also, I'll mention that again, It was near Moffatville, of course, where there's racing horse stables everywhere. We quite often see a horse that had broken free go racing through the traffic, and all the traffic would stop totally, and this horse would just be chronically racing. It's like dogs we used to see that you don't see anymore. Actually, I saw one the other day. Quite amazing. That was quite common in my childhood to see dogs running. Because they'd been dropped off somewhere and left, and they were running to get home. And quite often on Sundays when we went out to visit Grandma and Grandpa, there'd always be a dog that was running its heart out. And that was quite strange. But these horses, I really was quite fascinated by them. But the draft horses is one thing that my first partner compared me to. I said, he was like built like a racehorse. And I said, what do you think, what kind of animal am I? And he said, a draft horse. And I said, do you mean a Clydesdale or a Percheron? He said, a Clydesdale. I said, well, I'd rather be a Percheron, because they're the beautiful, white, elegant draft horses. But one day, I must have been very small, so we were 2.5 when we moved in. Mum had a little knitting shed, and I only had a brick before the door, and I kind of hid in there when these draft horses went crazy and they stampeded through our garden, and they just stampeded the whole house, and there was like a dozen draft horses just coming like crazy. I was so terrified. But I've always loved them. So I have a little series of very, very nice toys that are Clydesdales, and I have one perch on. I keep them in my bedroom. I was just wondering, from Leanne's question, is there anything more to say? My life at the moment is in a stage of not knowing what's happening, because I've just found out I've got cancer, and wanted a tattoo that was to give me strength. I looked on the computer, I could find nothing suitable at all, so I decided to look at my Scottish cairngorm, which is the brooch that would hold the plaid up with the tartan drape that was used in the Scottish tradition, as you carried your blanket with you, strapped across your shoulder, and it was massive, very heavy. And it's mine and my sister's were of the Scottish thistle, so I'm now designing my final tattoo, I think, or at least to gain strength, is going to be a thing, a round form with three Scottish thistles in it. And before my operation, it's going to be there to give me some of my Scottish strength.
Thank you, Anne.